timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. Greetings! This is your regularly scheduled Publius coming to you at 19 hours UTC on Saturday, the 26th of October, in the glorious future year of 2024. And I am coming to you from my home in Fort Worth, Texas. Yes. So, having traveled many, many, many miles by sea and rail and even by air, I am now back at home in beautiful Fort Worth, Texas. And after this show, I suppose, I'm going to do what I've been putting off for the last couple of days and go over to the polling place and vote in early voting. As I have mentioned, I feel a great deal of resentment over this election because I can't vote my conscience. I can't vote according to the issues. I just have to vote based on the preservation of the Republic, it being every citizen's duty to preserve the Constitution of the Republic. And as the last couple of days have made extremely clear, that is where we are at. We have had the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times, in both cases, the editorial boards prepare an endorsement only to have it quashed by their billionaire owners. That tells you something. We have had quite openly major donors for one party putting up a lot of money to try and reprise the chaos which followed the 2020 presidential election. We have even had a suggestion by a United States representative that there should be no election held in North Carolina because of the weather-related disasters there, and instead all of their electoral votes should simply be presumptively awarded to one candidate. I think you can see it is every citizen's duty to use whatever means are to hand to preserve the Constitution of the Republic. And the very first means is voting, for what good it may do in this case. As I have said, I am not 100% certain that, for example, Governor Abbott of Texas will not simply issue some kind of ukase to ignore the ballots cast. Now, on a much happier and, frankly, more interesting note, mail call, ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a, mail call. So, of course, I've been away from home for 10 weeks, and I always say, write to me, and when I get back, I'll read out whatever, I'll read whatever mail has accumulated. And I know that SDFer Christy O'Twisty had said that she was trying to persuade some of her postcard mailing friends to send me postcards for World Postcard Day. As some of you out there in a non-radio land know, I sent out quite a bit of postcards for World Postcard Day. Some people even received two, one sent from Budapest and one sent from Prague, morning and evening of the same day, which I was a trifle proud of doing, to be honest. But as it is, I honestly suspect that I spent something like $100 on overseas postage during my travels abroad. So I was hoping to get back and find my mailbox full of letters in return. Unfortunately, not terribly many of those. I do, however, here have a World Postcard Day postcard from Christy O'Twisty, which she had herself custom printed. Yes. So this is dated the 2nd of October, 2024. Greetings from 49 degrees, 14 minutes, 0.450 north, 123 degrees west, 5 minutes, 0.097. Thank you, Publius, for remembering me in your travels and twice blessing me with World Postcard Day cards, one from each country. Had I stayed north of 49 degrees north, 05.450, 123 degrees west, 06.220, I could do likewise. If any geocachers are listening, read out the trackable code. Happy trails, the stars are ours to navigate by, Christy O'Twisty. And then that geocaching code, which is for a site called discovergeocaching.com, the code is POK3EJ. That's Papa Oscar Kilo 3 Echo Juliet. So, anybody out there in a non-radio land who's interested in geocaching, you go to discovergeocaching.com, I suppose, and you put in the code Papa Oscar Kilo 3 Echo Juliet, and I guess there's a special message. Anyway, so these postcards have a little... I guess this is the geocaching mascot, a little frog with a little antenna sticking up from his head and lightning bolts coming from it. Looks like a kind of uncomfortable way to be a frog, but what do I know? And then there's also a thing that looks vaguely like the logo of a golf course. It's a square divided into four smaller squares with a standing human figure and a little pennant. I like to say, it makes me think of nothing so much as golf course. And then, I'm wondering if I, anyway, so yes, people who, anyway, so what else did I get? Well, as you heard by the sound of the letter opener there, an envelope. An envelope from whom? From Tobe. I can tell because of the rubber stamp impressions. Tobe. And the, Chinese New Year dragon mask stamp. That's a good one. And rubber stamp mandala on there. I think that's a rubber stamp impression in Chinese characters. Anyway, mail from Tobe is always an experience. But let us see what Tobe has sent me. Ooh, hell money. Yes. Chinese hell money. With the remarkably small denomination of $10,000 for Chinese hell money. It says, Joss paper made in China, which is good news. I'm glad that my Chinese hell money is made in China. Let's see. What else has Tobe sent me? Ooh, here is a flyer from OPPD. I guess this is Outlets is the name of their little mailer that they send around with the power bill. The flyer from OPPD describing the massive power outage that they had as a result of very powerful straight-line winds. So yes, this is the September 2024 edition. It says, Hurricane Force straight-line winds battered OPPD's service territory with confirmed gusts greater than 90 miles per hour. The storm caused severe widespread tree damage throughout the region, which caused many of the outages. Tree limbs and entire trees break and fall over and knock down poles and carry down wires with them. There's this great photograph of just a huge parking lot completely full of cherry picker trucks. It says, 170 mutual aid crews from all over Nebraska and multiple states arrived to help OPPD restore power to over 221,000 customers. The crews staged in UNO's Baxter Arena parking lots. I guess that's a big sports, that's a sports stadium complex there. Um, Now, obviously, this is good arguments for undergrounding power lines, but there are lots of places where that really ought to be done that it's not. They want to remind you, Nebraska is the only state where all residents get electricity from public power utilities or cooperatives. Let's see. So note here about the Platteview Solar Facility. OPPD's first utility-scale solar project, the largest of its kind in Nebraska, is now generating power for customers. The new facility, known as Platteview Solar, is capable of producing 81 megawatts of electricity, enough to power 14,000 homes. On 500 acres of private land near Utan, the facility generates power with 188,000 solar panels arranged in neat rows. And there's a photo of it. Ooh, 7 by 2.5 inch ad space available in 2024. Proceeds benefit EAP. Proceeds from the sale of advertising space and outlets are donated to the Energy Assistance Program, which helps people who can't afford their power bills pay their power bills. Advertisement and outlets does not constitute an endorsement. For information about this space, please call. I wonder if I could get an advertisement for nuclear power into this, right? I want to put a Man and Adam Society advertisement in that with a message saying, just go ahead and reopen Fort Calhoun already, you chowderheads. And there's a note, handwritten note here, which I believe may be from Tobe himself. It says, Platteview Solar Facility, there were 189,922 households per 2020 census inside the city limits, less than half the population of the metropolitan area. We will require 6,783 more acres of solar panels just to electrify the remainder of that half of the population. 13,565 acres for the entire metro area, or one-seventh of the area itself. OPPD does not own or operate a solar facility. And yes, it has a power purchase agreement, it says, with the AES Corporation, the facility's developer, owner, and operator. And I will point out, it says, capable of producing 81 megawatts of electricity, enough to power 14,000 homes. What I would like to know is, on an average year-round basis, how much does it actually produce? Because if that's the peak figure, then on an average year-round basis, it probably produces about 15% of that. Which is not very heartening. So yes, the thought of placing an ad in this newsletter that says, just restart your darn nuclear reactor already, you chowderheads, really appeals to me, particularly considering that the one nuclear power plant in Iowa, which was shut down a couple of years ago on the claim that the combination of wind and cheap gas made it uneconomical to operate, that nuclear power plant is seriously being considered for restarting. Tobe complaining about a politician campaigning on the platform of lower energy costs when Nebraskans already have the lowest electricity costs basically going. So yes, that was it for mail call. Maybe I'll see a little more mail here from y'all in the next week or two. I would certainly enjoy that. I would appreciate it. That would be wonderful. Anyhow, what else is there to be said about that? It's a colored pencil. Tobe does not like this particular candidate, not only because of his nonsensical platform, but also because anytime Tobe goes to use YouTube, Tobe gets a whole bunch of ads, either from the guy or from people who are running ads against him. Either way, he doesn't want to see the ads. Isn't that the truth? I have not, you know... Now, the bizarre thing about using YouTube in Europe is that you have, you know, cookies switched off and whatever, and they just serve you really random ads, which are vaguely amusing sometimes in the sense of, wow, this is not an ad for a product or service that I would ever want or even conceive of using. But no, I keep saying that I'm going to go to my grandfather's grave at the Veterans Cemetery over here, the Dallas-Fort Worth Veterans Cemetery, and burn some Chinese hell money over his grave on the grounds that, given that he fought the Japanese in the Second World War, you know, that some kind of Chinese funerary offering is probably appropriate, you know, since the only reason the U.S. got in that war in the first place was on behalf of the Chinese. For those who don't know about Chinese hell money, the thing is that historically, dating back to ancient times, in many cultures there has been a practice of grave goods. In other words, of burying with the deceased various valuable items that they treasured during life. And in Chinese culture particularly, we see this, for example, with the Terracotta Army, which was buried in the tomb of Qin Shi Huangdi, right? Which, of course, supersedes earlier practices where actual people would be buried alive, or human sacrifices would occur on the death of an important leader, or they would kill somebody's, and kill a whole cavalry regiment's worth of horses and whatever, and put them in the grave so that you could ride horses in the afterlife, that kind of thing. The Egyptians did a lot of tomb paintings. In addition to grave goods, they did a lot of tomb paintings and carvings to show what they wanted the deceased to have in the afterlife. But in East Asia, particularly where ancestor worship funerary cults are very important, certainly were very important up until sometime between the end of the 19th and middle of the 20th centuries, when, of course, severe social disruptions occurred to many of those practices. But also countries where, generally speaking, the means of subsistence always are a bit squeezed, there was a general tendency away from destroying or burying actual valuable items towards representations of them, spiritual versions of the items, in other words. And so if you go to Chinese grocery stores and places like that, you can get little paper models of gold ingots and cars and houses and what have you, as well as the same kind of paper, either printed with money banknote designs, or in some cases with little bits of gold leaf adhered to it, which doesn't actually cost very much because, of course, as you know, gold can be beaten out to near molecular thinness. You know, it's almost single atom layers. And so the result is that as a funerary practice and as a practice of veneration for the deceased when visiting their graves, one will take along these paper models of things that the deceased might wish to have in the afterlife and then set fire to them. And then the idea, of course, is that as they're consumed by the flames, the spiritual essence of what is represented is transferred to the other side, as it were. And I find this quite a fascinating idea. I think it reveals a great deal about the way people think. And, of course, it also makes me wonder how much of modern economics is really that on a grand scale. I mean, you think about the vast financial transactions which occur every day with no underlying value, essentially. You have derivatives of derivatives. You have these very elaborate financial instruments and mechanisms whereby vast sums of theoretical money are counterpoised against each other in an exceedingly delicate balance. It's been calculated that at any moment the sum total of the puts and calls and long positions and short positions and so on in the financial markets is many times the annual total economic output of all the countries on Earth taken together. And it seems to me that there is a symmetry or a resonance or at least a resemblance between burning the funerary offerings in the form of paper and these vast, not even paper anymore, vast conceptual debit and credit sheets, which horrendously or hilariously, depending on how you look at it, dominate and control so much of our lives today. Rolly says that I'm his reason for waking up early on Sundays. Wow, that's quite a compliment. I appreciate it, man. So that's, you know, that's a thought that I've had, and if anybody can extend it further, you're certainly welcome to see where that idea takes you. Now, there's of course a great deal of odd things going on right now in the world. There's probably never been any time in history when there weren't a great deal of odd things going on, but just to give you one example, there have been a lot of folks who have been very hopeful that the European Union would step in and do some hard, heavy-handed regulation of the computers and information technology industries, industrial sectors, which the United States has been very reluctant to do because it really keeps the gravy train running so far as the investment markets are concerned. And again, you know, I talk about this a lot, I suppose, the idea that this phantom economy is controlling the real economy, the world that we actually live in, where our day-to-day business transactions, the kinds of transactions that result in people being housed and clothed and fed, goods and services being produced and delivered, those kinds of things occur. So a lot of, as I say, a lot of people have been hopeful that the European Union would take a stronger line, but this week has certainly not been very cheering in that regard. Something like 15 years ago, the European Antitrust Competition Regulator handed down a fine of over €1 billion against Intel for monopolistic behavior regarding microprocessors with the x86 type instruction set, and very elaborate schemes of kickbacks and discounts and this and that and the other thing meant to assure that Intel dominated the market in these processors. And just this past week, after 15 years of appeals and travail, the European Court of Justice quashed the fine. Finally. Now, there's still about a €350 million fine, which is still being contested as a subpart of the initial fine, but it doesn't look particularly good in that regard. And this is not what I would call a hopeful sign. This is not what I call a hopeful sign. You know, there's been a lot of discussion recently, particularly apropos of the United States Supreme Court and its frankly bizarre behavior about judicial power and how that should be exercised and to whom it should be responsible. You know, on the one hand, you have the United States Supreme Court, where you have, to be frank, you have people who call themselves originalists. Now, I'm not going to debate the merits of originalism as a position here. I think it does have merit. On the other hand, I can also see the case made by the people who say, well, the Constitution was written by a bunch of old, white, dead white guys, half of whom owned slaves. Why should we really even care what they thought? And I think that the major answer to that is simply that, well, those folks also included explicit mechanisms for changing the Constitution. So reinterpreting it as a, quote, living document is a bit of an iffy enterprise when it's possible to actually change what it says if your understanding of what it ought to say changes. But that to one side. You have so-called originalists who are doing things like going directly against dicta of Chief Justice Marshall, who is basically the father of American constitutional jurisprudence, who are going against, or at least violently narrowing the scope of legislation passed by the first Congress. Something called the Alien Torts Statute, for example, which was intended to keep the U.S. out of certain kinds of international conflicts and embranglements by allowing foreigners to sue in U.S. courts. Well, the Supreme Court recently has been trying to narrow the scope of an alien tort statute so that it doesn't apply against corporations, which, again, is completely against the jurisprudence of our first Supreme Court, our first Chief Justice. Then, on the other hand, for example, you have in Poland, where there has been a strong push to make the Supreme Court there much more subservient to the government in power at the time. Where you had these fairly hard-right politicians who were being stymied by judges who simply refused to go along with what they were doing, and so they decided, well, what we can do is rewrite the way that the court system works and make the judges shorten their terms, make them more dependent on the parliament, and so on. And of course, this kind of thing, although certainly there are people who would embrace that kind of reform for the United States, specifically with the idea of making the Supreme Court more answerable and responsive to the needs and demands of the public, the truth is that with the continuing gridlock and just plain incompetence in the House of Representatives and the Senate, that's not actually as attractive as it first seems, because who knows what they're going to come up with? You know, that there's a lot of things where the courts have stepped in to effectively make law simply because what the legislature has done is to either create something that can't be implemented as written, or something that's so vague as to require a great deal of interpretation. So when it comes to systems of government, systems of politics, and so forth, you're often sort of between two fires. You know, Scylla on one hand and Charybdis on the other. And as in all things, the biggest thing that is required is goodwill and a desire for society to continue. And that, I'm afraid, is what we are seeing all over the world is badly missing. Anyhow, you've been listening to A Step Farther Out on AnonRadio.net, which is a service of the SDF Public Access Unix system. Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, 76101, United States.